Good morning and welcome to Greater Good. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, from the Sun Sounds of Arizona Studios. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good. How to build a compassionate workplace. There are many ways that organizations can show that they care for their people and the world, and many benefits to doing so. By Ace V. Simpson, July 29th, 2025. If employees are feeling overworked and stressed and anxious, what is the solution? Many discussions about burnout inevitably turn to ideas like mindfulness and self-compassion, skills that can be taught to workers to improve their mental health and, particularly in healthcare, enhance patient care. But that puts the burden on the employee. What about the responsibility of the organization? While we ask people to be compassionate with themselves, we must also encourage organizations to be compassionate toward their people. This was the starting point for a conversation hosted by the University of Michigan's Center for Positive Organizations between their faculty director, Monica Warline, and Ace Simpson, director of the Center for Compassion Studies in New York, and a visiting professor of management at Manhattan University. They discussed how to cultivate a culture and practice of organizational compassion and addressed some of the common concerns leaders may have about it. Here is an edited version of their Q&A. Monica Warline, could you tell us what you mean by compassion and why you emphasize that it's a relational process? Ace V. Simpson, when we talk about organizational compassion, our emphasis is on the other. We define compassion within organizations as noticing, empathizing with, appraising, and responding to members' suffering. Even so, that definition has limitations, as it reflects the giver's perspective, the one who notices, empathizes, appraises, and responds. But where is the person receiving the compassion in that definition? In our book, Organizational Compassion, A Relational Approach, we have sought to address that by broadening perspectives. We ask questions about the role of the receiver in the compassion process and give them a voice. We seek to understand how it's their signaling for support that actually triggers the compassion process. It's their emoting, their fears and concerns and angst that need to be empathized with. It's their narrating or explaining the context of their struggles that enables the appraisal. And it's the person who struggles, who's challenged, who's suffering, by describing what they need to address their concerns, who facilitates adequate responding. Organizational compassion, then, is a co-created process between receivers and givers, one that unfolds through signaling and noticing, emoting and empathizing, narrating and appraising, describing needs and responding with support to address suffering in the workplace. Monica Warline, what does the research tell us about why we should care about organizational compassion? Ace Simpson. Our research shows that when compassion is supported in the workplace, when people are able to express care and support for one another or receive it from their supervisors or mentors, when they see it demonstrated by their leaders, they feel a greater sense of loyalty, commitment, and trust. When they feel cared for, and when they see that the organization cares, they're more inspired to give their discretionary time and energy to their colleagues and to the organization. When organizations pay attention to their people and support them with compassion, particularly during their times of struggle or distress, that compassion tends to come back to the organization in the form of goodwill, loyalty, and engagement. It also leads to better customer outcomes because when employees care about the organization, that care spills over into how they treat customers or patients. That would be a kind of utilitarian argument, a business case for why compassion matters in organizations. But beyond that, it's also simply the right thing to do, an expression of virtue and a recognition of human dignity. Monica Warline. You talk a lot about how leaders use their role and the power they have to foster greater compassion. What are some specific things you see leaders doing to facilitate compassion across an organization? Ace Simpson. Leaders do play a pivotal role in fostering compassion within their organizations, first and foremost, by simply giving permission to others to be compassionate. We say that suffering is always in the room, but we could also say that there's always compassion there as well. In any social dynamic, there will be micro acts of kindness, and organizations are no different. Day to day, people cover for each other. They provide slack for one another. They support one another in different ways emotionally, but also practically as well. And this facilitates day-to-day organizational functioning, although it's not necessarily taught in business schools or acknowledged in management and organizational theory. We might even say that organizations couldn't function without those micro practices of care and compassion. Leaders can highlight that. They can acknowledge it, recognize it, encourage it, and facilitate it. They can demonstrate that this is really important and matters within their organization. A great example of a leader who emphasized compassion within his organization was Jeff Weiner, the former CEO of LinkedIn. He would talk about managing compassionately. He would talk about how he applied this in his own leadership by pausing before reacting, understanding others' hopes and fears, and trying to foster their well-being and success. So that's the first thing that a leader can do. They can role model compassion for other leaders within their organizations. They can take that further by seeking to foster it within organizational processes. Weiner taught workshops on managing compassionately and organized programs for employees across the organization. They organized compassionate leadership summits and more broadly sought to integrate it into other organizational processes. If compassion doesn't have the support of leadership, it will be there, but it will be underground, so to speak. When it is supported by leadership, then it can really flourish and thrive. Monica Warline. For people who aren't in positions of leadership or executive influence, what can they do to create a more compassionate organization without having the support of leadership? A. Simpson. What comes to mind are Peter Frost's toxin handlers. That's where a compassionate leader or supervisor lower down the organizational hierarchy becomes a defender of their team or people, defending them against unreasonable deadlines and demands that come from headquarters that can undermine their well-being and psychological safety and security. That would be an extreme case because Frost's toxin handlers often take a personal hit. It undermines their own physical health and well-being as they shield their people from toxicity that comes from higher up in the organization. Compassion can involve resistance to oppression and abuse. That would be an example of compassion as strength, and it takes a lot of courage to be that kind of leader, supporting your people in that way. If you were going to take that role, you need to be able to deal with that internally yourself and to have an outlet, peers that you can speak with, coaches who can support you. It's a process of self-awareness, not just being the angry compassion warrior. It's about turning that toxicity, that poison, into nectar. Aside from that, the manager or team leader lower down in the organization can view their division as a micro-organization within the larger system. Compassionate processes can be integrated within a division just as much as across the entire organization. I've certainly seen that in healthcare organizations and other sectors. When we look at data from our surveys, we often find divisions where employees rate their team very highly in terms of compassion, and others where that's not the case, all within the same organization. The fact that you find such disparities within the same system indicates that it's possible for a leader to create a microculture within their team division. Monica Warline, what are some of the organizational features that get in the way and inhibit compassion across the system, or that enable it? A. Simpson, culture is really important. Culture can normalize compassion or not. And when it does, it can create an environment where people feel safer to address mistakes and concerns, to communicate with one another, to be vulnerable, and to reach out and support one another. Another key factor is leadership. Leadership plays a critical role, not only in role modeling, but also in ensuring that compassion is integrated across the organization. Then there are routines, daily rituals, check-ins, and processes of the organization. Who does it hire? What does it value in terms of performance? Is it purely a metric of productivity? Or is there also a relational dimension to how performance is evaluated? You might have a top sales agent who hits their targets by trampling on colleagues. Communication is also important. Having open communication, empathetic channels, and opportunities for people to voice concerns and be heard without fear of reprisal. And then, related to culture, are mission and values. A lot of the time, organizations profess a certain mission or set of values, but then there's a disconnect between the espoused values and the actual practices. Being aligned, there is also of vital importance. Monica Warline, In a moment like this, when cost cutting is at the forefront of the organizational agenda, does compassion have a place? Ace Simpson, absolutely. Cost cutting may be required for an organization's survival, and a leader has to make those tough choices because they need to think about the organization as a whole. The leader is responsible for all the employees and all those who are stakeholders within that organization. But cost cutting can be done in a manner that lacks compassion, or it can be done with a lot of empathy and a lot of care, where the leader speaks to the employees and explains why these decisions are made and explains the different choices that were available. It involves being held accountable for the decisions made. Sometimes leaders try to lead through spreadsheets, and they just say, the data said we had to do it. But there are always choices, and there are great examples of organizations like Costco or Southwest or Hilton facing the question of whether to lay off employees after a global financial crisis or after, let's say, 9/11, when people are too afraid to fly. As an airline, what are you going to do? You have to reduce the number of routes you're flying, which may mean laying people off. Or the organization could go to employees and say, we need to reduce the number of routes for now. We could lay some of you off, but what we're going to do is to ask you all to work fewer hours or take a temporary payout. Once things return to normal, we'll increase your hours and restore your original pay. Alternatively, organizations can support employees by helping them find alternative employment, offering counseling and career guidance, or training them for work in other areas as well. Monica Warline, how can you ensure that a compassionate leader is not manipulated or exploited? Ace Simpson. There is that fear that if I'm kind or compassionate, others might take that for weakness and then manipulate me and take advantage. And yes, that possibility will always be there. One option is to decide, okay, I'm not going to be compassionate. I'll just present a tough exterior, suppress my compassionate side, and say it has no role or place here. The other option is to acknowledge that, yes, I might occasionally be taken advantage of, but I'm willing to take that risk as a leader. Sometimes a team member may take sick leave when they're not really unwell, or someone might exploit the system in another way. But I would hope and expect that as I act compassionately and supportively, we build a certain level of trust between us. And within that context of trust, loyalty, commitment, and engagement created through a compassionate environment, the likelihood of being taken for granted or manipulated diminishes considerably. Monica Warline. You've talked about pre-response rather than waiting for suffering and responding to it. What do you mean by that? Ace Simpson. We often talk about compassion as a response to suffering, and that framing can be problematic. There's also suffering that we can anticipate in advance. For example, during mergers and acquisitions, or periods of organizational change. There's also suffering that can arise within the organization in terms of bullying. Organizations can and should anticipate this. If we broaden our thinking about compassion, not only as responding to suffering, but also anticipating it, anticipating the pain that will inevitably arise from processes that are unfolding, then being a compassionate leader means responding to that anticipated suffering as well. That's when we really need to begin to broaden our understanding of what compassion entails and involves. About the author, Ace V. Simpson, PhD, is visiting professor of management at Manhattan University and director of the Center for Compassion Studies. His research and writing explore workplace compassion, humility, and psychological safety, as well as the paradoxes of power and leadership. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, bringing you Greater Good Magazine. And we have time for a Greater Good in Action practice that relates to this article, and it's entitled, Ask for Help at Work. Overcome your reluctance and discover how kind other people are. How to do it. Time required. Just a few minutes whenever you need a favor at work. In the long run, asking for help may actually save you time by making your work more efficient. How to do it. In this exercise, rather than practicing kindness towards others, we are going to give someone else the opportunity to practice kindness towards us by asking them for a favor. Think of some area of your work where you could use a little help. Maybe you are struggling with a task and would benefit from a colleague's opinion or expertise. Or you are going on vacation and would like someone to cover one of your responsibilities. Perhaps you're experiencing some tension with a coworker and need advice on how to resolve it. Whatever the case, identify the person who's in the best position to help you and make a direct request of them. You might be surprised by the answer. Why to try it? Asking for help can feel vulnerable. Especially at work, we often strive to appear competent and capable, and seeking out help is an admission that we can't do our jobs alone. We may also worry about imposing on our coworkers if they say yes and feeling awkward if they say no. Luckily, research suggests that many of our fears about asking for help are unfounded. In fact, we tend to underestimate the chance of a positive response by up to 50%, meaning that a yes is much more likely than we think. Why it works. Why do we underestimate how willing people are to help us? When we ask for help, we tend to focus on the burden of the task, like how complex it is and how much time it will take. But when we're asked for help, our focus is different. Instead, we're aware of how difficult, embarrassing, and awkward it can be to say no. As a result, we say yes quite regularly. Lest you worry about pressuring other people to help you, a great deal of research suggests that helping also feels good. So when other people comply with your requests, they get a happiness boost too. Evidence that it works. In this study, participants asked others for help in various types, including directions, a cell phone to borrow, and a charitable donation. Ultimately, they received many more positive responses than expected, partly because they didn't realize how uncomfortable it is to say no. And this was taken from, the study was published by the authors Flynn and Lake, If you need help, just ask. Underestimating Compliance with Direct Requests for Help, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, Volume 95, Issue 1, pages 128 to 143. You have been listening to Greater Good Magazine, coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, thanking you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. And now, stay tuned for more interesting programming, coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona.